This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Governor Ron DeSantis is pledging $50 million for spring's cleanup. Environmentalists have been sounding the alarm for years about the declining quality of Florida's numerous springs and waterways. Silver Springs is perhaps the best known example of a spring that was once crystal clear, but it now is plagued with algae caused by nutrient pollution. And that's a problem not just for the tourists and Floridians who flock to the springs in summertime, but it's also a problem for the wildlife too. Algal blooms disrupt the ecosystem, choking the native vegetation. So the big question is, how will that $50 million be spent, and is it going to be enough? What springs do you enjoy swimming or paddling in, and what have you noticed about water quality in recent years? We're talking about the health of the springs, and we're taking your calls. The number is 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can reach out to us on Twitter with your questions and comments too. We're at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining us in the studio, Amy Green, 90.7's environmental reporter. Amy, thanks for being back here.
It's nice to talk with you.
Also joined by Russell Bryant. He swims in the Wakaiva Springs every day. Russell, thanks for making the trip in as well.
My pleasure.
And Clay Henderson with the Stetson Water Institute joins us as well. Clay, thanks as well.
Happy to be here.
You can call in with your questions and comments about the health of the springs and how to restore them. The number is 1-866-338-5252. If you have some comments and questions, not near a phone, you want to comment on Twitter as well, you can do that. We're at the WMFE Orlando. Well, on the campaign trail, Ron DeSantis said he would work to clean up the Everglades and tackle the toxic algal blooms that have plagued coastal communities in recent years. In his first weeks as governor, DeSantis has pledged to spend money to fix those environmental issues, and he's taken steps to shake up the South Florida Water Management District. But what about Florida Springs? Let's listen to Governor DeSantis talking to reporters in Orlando yesterday.
That's $50 million for 1 year. Obviously, I think the springs cleanup is something that's an ongoing. As you know, the legislature passed a bill within the last couple years on that. I think it's important. It's important to different parts of the state. So we're committed to doing it and getting it right. Now, having said that, I think if you look around the state, the acute problems that we've seen in certain parts of the state with the algae and the red tide, you know, have had a really significant effect on the quality of life and the economies in those areas. And so if you look at how we're doing it, you know, we are definitely emphasizing those problems just because I think those problems have been the most severe, and they're the types of problems that, you know, if we're not making progress on, I think could get even worse.
That's Governor Ron DeSantis in Orlando yesterday talking about the money set aside for springs restoration. Amy Green, let me come to you. How does that compare with the money that the governor is talking about for other environmental projects?
Right, yeah. So this week, Governor Ron DeSantis unveiled a spending plan that is basically aimed at implementing just a sweeping executive order that he signed earlier in January, really targeting this huge problem of toxic algae that we saw last year. And his spending plan puts $625 million toward water resources, including $360 million for Everglades, $107 million for an Everglades agricultural area reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee, and $150 million for water quality, including septic tanks. Mm-hmm. Kind of lower on the list of priorities was springs, $50 million for springs.
Although $150 million for things including septic tanks, that has an impact on springs, right, and other waterways.
That's absolutely right, yeah.
Well, Clay Henderson, if I come to you, $50 million for springs, given that it's only 1 year, as the governor pointed out, does that sound like a good amount of money? Would you like to see more spent on springs restoration?
Well, we need to get the money out into the projects. As the governor said, it's an ongoing issue. 3 years ago, as he alluded to, the legislature passed the Florida Legacy Act, which dedicates $50 million a year for springs restoration funding for the duration of the Amendment 1 program. That was a huge program that was approved in 2014. So the last 3 years, the legislature has appropriated $50 million for springs projects. Mm-hmm. But last year, 2018, the legislature approved $50 million. The water management districts, including our own St. John's, recommended projects. DEP then came up with a list of the projects, and that money is yet to be released because the legislature put on it a proviso that said it had to be approved by the Joint Legislative Budget Commission, and they just haven't gotten around doing it yet. So We got $50 million in the hopper right now that needs to get out where it needs to do some good work.
Can you give me a sense of what some of those projects would be or what they are?
Sure. There are a range of projects. Depending upon if you're a spring like Wekiva, which is mostly influenced by septic tanks, or if you're a North Florida spring that is mostly influenced by agricultural runoff. So there are some sewer to septic or septic to sewer conversions. There are some stormwater retrofits. And there are programs to reduce agricultural use of fertilizers in North Florida.
Mm-hmm. If you were to make a list of things that you think the money should be spent on right now, what would be right at the top of that list, Clay Henderson?
Well, first of all, the state needs to come to grips with the intent of Amendment 1, which was to buy lands for conservation. And even though there's been this $50 million a year committed to springs restoration, there really hasn't been much at all that's gone into buying up lands around the springs. The second issue, which is so critical, and it's not just for springs, but also like the Indian River Lagoon, are these septic to sewer conversions. Mm-hmm. Wekiva Springs and Blue Springs here in Volusia County, the majority of the nutrients that are going into those springs are from septic tanks.
Amy Green, I mean, you mentioned that sort of pot of money at the start of our conversation, some of that going towards septic tanks, and Clay Henderson brings up the Indian River Lagoon, which you've done plenty of reporting on. How does septic tanks sort of factor in the list of things that lawmakers think are important to improving the health of Florida's waterways?
Septic tanks are a big problem because they just keep coming. You know, we just keep seeing new development, and part of that new development is new septic tanks, and mm-hmm. the cost of converting those septic tanks to sewer is extraordinarily expensive. And so that likely, it's possible that will be a question during the legislative session. We know that we need to convert a lot of these septic tanks to sewers, and the question is, who's going to pay for it? It's so expensive. Whose financial responsibility is that? Does that belong to the state or to the municipalities?
Mm-hmm. But there is that money that the state is setting aside, at least some of it, to try and get some of that done.
Yes, that's true. But I think converting septic tanks to sewer is so expensive. Clay Henderson might know a dollar amount, but my impression is it's just an extraordinary cost.
Mm-hmm. Does that sort of tally with what you know about this issue, Clay Henderson?
Oh, sure. I mean, it varies from county to county depending upon how much infrastructure and lines they're in place. But, you know, an individual conversion can be anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 and usually kind of in the upper end of that. So we're talking about Indian River Lagoon. It's 250,000 septic tanks in that watershed. So do the math. Up in Wekiva and Blue Spring here, I mean, we're talking about, thousands, like 50,000 septic tanks here in Blue Spring. So these are major things. On the other hand, you know, again, look at Blue Spring. The major contribution is septic tanks because of Deltona. Deltona is the biggest city in Volusia County, and most of it's on septic tank, and that was just never – septic tanks were never designed to deal with that volume of waste.
Mm, interesting. We're talking about the health of Florida's waterways and springs. Want to hear from you. What are you seeing in the springs? Do you have a favorite spring to go to, and have you noticed the water quality changing in recent years? You can give us a call. We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can also reach out to us on Twitter with your comments and questions at WMFE Orlando. Well, Russell Bryant, I know many people swim in the springs in summertime, but you maybe have a slightly different aspect or a different approach or a different appreciation of the springs, because you swim in the Wekiva Springs every single day. Just give me a sense of what you do, what you see, and what keeps you coming back to these springs.
Well, I'm a volunteer there, so I have an excuse to go, and I have an annual pass, which gets me in, and I have an early hour permit, which allows me to go before they open in the summer. So it's an opportunity, and I'm a native Floridian. I just think it's amazing. We have more springs than any other place in the world, and I'm just lucky to live near one of the better ones, Wekiva Springs. It is a fabulous place to swim. 43 million gallons of water coming out every day. Go early enough, and it's your private swimming pool, particularly at this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the water is always 72. So this time of year, I'm warmer in the water than the snowbirds walking around looking at me like, who's that crazy old man in the water?
Have you managed to convert some of them into swimmers as well?
Yes, yes. I ask, where are your bathing suits? And they say, well, we're thinking about it, you know, and they'll go disappear, maybe come back. I'm not quite sure. But the nice thing of this time of year is that we have a lifeguard, and he's a 5-foot blue heron called Henry. And so Henry's on the side looking for his breakfast, and it's just a magical experience to be there, surrounded by wilderness. And it's all mine.
So Clay Henderson was talking about the septic tank issue and saying that that is one of the main contributors to the declining water quality of the Wekiva Springs in particular. You've been swimming in those springs for a number of years. What have you seen?
Well, I have met people who can remember when the springs were blue. Up until about the 80s, they were blue as they had been for thousands of years. They're now tone of green, thanks to the algae on the bottom. And it's disappointing that what was once so beautiful and the home for thousands of years of Native Americans has been allowed to, because of our compassion for endless development, to turn it into a problem with algae. But the biggest problem at Wekiva these days is the bulkheads are slowly deteriorating because they haven't been repaired since the park was built. There's one exception. They just did the west side because it was falling down.
What are they made of?
Concrete and mostly concrete down to the below the water level. But I'm worried that money spent for dealing with the algae, it was probably going to be sidetracked to deal with the bulkhead problem. I mean, that there's this invasive species of armored catfish who dig holes into the bulkhead so that you go underwater and you see these holes all around and the bulkhead is kind of suspended in air and you wonder, how much longer can this last? Yeah.
We were talking the other day about your kind of impression, your experience of swimming in the springs, and you talked to me about one other aspect of the catfish that you'd noticed. Tell me about what else they're up to besides burrowing tunnels into the concrete.
Well, it's all very well to talk about $5 billion $5 million to repair the algae, but the only algae repair that's taking place is that there's this, these armored catfish are eating the algae inside the boil. And so suddenly inside the main boil, the walls are almost clean because you see dozens of these armored catfish munching away at the algae. So there's something being done, but it's not what the governor or has in mind about getting rid of the algae.
And just for our listeners, the boil is the main kind of outlet for the water, right? This is where the millions of gallons come up every day.
Every day.
Amy, I saw you raising your hand there.
Yeah, I just thought I would mention, you know, Russell has been talking about this green algae problem at the Wekiva Springs, and I just thought I would explain that, you know, really at the heart of these water quality problems that we're talking about is algae and nutrient pollution. And the reason we're talking about septic tanks is because a lot of the nutrient pollution behind these what are called harmful algae blooms is nutrient pollution that comes from septic tanks. It comes from fertilizer use and all of these things. And so that's why we're so focused on this problem of nutrient pollution. Historically, this is kind of a new problem, and it's a very pervasive problem across the country. It's one of the top consequences of the alterations that we as, you know, modern humanity kind of have made to our waterways across the country. And so this nutrient pollution, it's a growing problem. It's one that Governor DeSantis has proposed a sweeping plan to try to get a grip on. But this is a big problem, and this is a complicated problem.
I guess the biggest or the most catastrophic impact of that that we've seen has been the blue-green algae that has been clogging up waterways along the coast, right? But I wonder if it's a little more subtle when you think about what's happening in those freshwater springs and rivers.
That's right. You heard Governor DeSantis talk about the toxic algae blooms that we experienced last year that just gripped the peninsula. But this is a problem really across the peninsula. The scientific term for these algae blooms, the scientific term is harmful algae bloom, or a lot of scientists call them HABs. And these are algae blooms that really kind of take over an ecosystem, whether they're toxic or not. These algae blooms, like the one that Russell is talking about in the Wekiva, they can take over an ecosystem. They can choke out native vegetation. They can prevent sunlight from reaching the bottom of these waterways and kind of nourishing the seagrasses that are on the floor of these waterways. And so that's some of the problems that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Clay Henderson, want to ask you about some legal action that's been taken by environmental groups. So back in January, just a day or two ago, I guess, but back in January this year, those groups took legal action against restoration plans for 15 of Florida's most important springs and hundreds of smaller springs. The plans were adopted last summer after lawmakers approved that measure in 2016, calling for restoration plans for 24 of the state's most important springs. That's what you were alluding to, I believe, at the start of the conversation. But what do you know about this legal action, and what's been the sort of motivation? Is it just the fact that the legislature hasn't got its act into gear and approved the money to be spent on these projects that you mentioned?
Actually, that's not the answer, but you have to have those projects to be able to do the cleanup. Mm-hmm. Just real quick on it, you're right. The legislature in 2016 passed the Florida Aquifer and Springs Protection Act, and it required the water management districts and DEP to take certain actions within a two-year period. And those plans were all to be approved on July 1 of last year. And that included all the first magnitude springs like Wekiva and Volusia Blue, and then included a number of other springs that were called outstanding Florida springs, such as DeLeon and Gemini Springs up here in Volusia. So the Springs Council, groups like Friends of the Wekiva, Save the Manatee Club up here in Volusia, were all very much involved in every step of that process. We had scientists involved in commenting on all the plans. And, you know, while we think there's a lot of good in this and we all need to be thinking about restoration, the conclusion that many of us had was that these plans did not go nearly far enough to address the issue. And without getting into the weeds on this, I'll give you just one example, mm-hmm. which is Blue Spring that we've talked about. There are probably 500 manatees there today, critical habitat for manatees. 54% of the nutrient pollution into Blue Springs is from septic tanks, and yet there was no project in this plan, restoration plan, to address septic tanks. So how are you going to clean it up? So that's why the actions were filed, and we hope that the new administration, with its interest and emphasis here on water quality protection, might direct DEP to help these plans get a little better.
Got a call coming in now from Martin. Martin, you're on the air. What are you hearing and what are you thinking about the springs when you listen to this conversation?
Well, about pollution in general, I want to comment that a lot of the pollution is people fertilizing their lawns, mm-hmm. whether you call it over-fertilizing or just fertilizing, dumping fertilizer on your lawns and having the runoff go into the lakes and rivers is probably as much, if not more, of a problem than the septic tanks.
Right.
And until you tell people that they don't get to have these pretty green lawns, you're not going to solve the problem.
That's kind of a big ask, though, right? People do love their lush green lawns.
I agree. It's impossible. As with many of our environmental problems, I think I'm pretty cynical. I think the problem will solve itself, and I don't think humanity will be happy with that. But
Well, I guess we'll see. But I want to thank
to the wall. I gotta hang up. I gotta go to work.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling in, Martin. I appreciate it. Amy Green, you do see driving around. I know Martin sounds a little bit despondent about the lawns there, but you do see signs in various communities, especially around the Indian River Lagoon. I have a Florida-friendly lawn, right? You'll see people have those signs, and they have a lawn which isn't really a lawn. It's more like a kind of collection of various different plants. Probably don't have to water it very much. It's not like a uniform green. So there are sort of steps being taken to encourage people to plant different things in their front yard.
Right, that's right. The caller is absolutely right. Fertilizers are a big part of this problem because fertilizers function in our waterways in exactly the same way they function on our lawns. The nutrients that feed our lawns, the nutrients that are a part of these fertilizers that feed our lawns and make them green, they do exactly the same thing in our waterways. They feed these algae blooms that can choke an ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Clay Henderson, listening to that caller there, I mean, do you sort of share the same sense of cynicism or pessimism when it comes to kind of getting people to change their habits, whether it's getting off of a septic tank system or changing the way or changing what you do with your front yard?
Sure. No, I don't have that cynicism. I think actually the caller is spot on in the terms that this is where we could probably move the needle the fastest, the cheapest, and the cheapest if we undertook an education campaign to help our citizens know you don't need to fertilize in the summertime unless you just enjoy mowing the lawn a lot in that hot weather. And if you're using reuse water to water your lawn, which would be a great thing, you don't need to put any fertilizer on at all. Mm-hmm. And we all need to understand what Florida-friendly standards are, and that's what we need to be doing. And if we all did that, it wouldn't cost the government much at all, and we would see an impact. It's not as much as septic tanks. It's 10 to 15% of the problem. But it's a quick and inexpensive way to move the needle if we could just all start doing that.
Russell Bryant, you strike me as a bit of an evangelist for Wakaiva Springs in particular and springs in general. You enjoy obviously having the springs to yourself, but would you just, you know, by and large, like to have more people out there swimming in the springs alongside you?
I would like to have more people there with rakes, raking up the algae. We used to be able to do that, but we were stopped. I used to get high school and college students to come and rake the springs. Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me that's the logical solution because it's going to take decades to get the nitrogen going down from septics and fertilized into the aquifer and coming back up to be eliminated. But there are too many vested interests in the status quo, so it proved impossible to continue having volunteers come and try to at least remove the physical evidence of mm-hmm. the algae.
When you kind of communicate to somebody who maybe hasn't seen these springs before, that it's sort of a marvelous natural treasure, do you kind of feel like you're doing part of the work that you want to, though, to sort of raise the profile of the springs and spread the word about why they should be preserved?
Yes. I mean, but it's an easy task because, I mean, people who walk past just stop and look in amazement that there's this wonderful natural facility where you can swim year-round and you don't need a wetsuit, and it's available to the public. I mean, I've met lots of people from all around the world. My Christmas card list gets longer and longer each year because of people that fall in love with Wakaiva, and I befriend them, and we stay in touch.
Amy Green, in the final few seconds we have here, obviously there's a lot of focus on the Everglades, and you've been reporting on that as well, but how do you see the springs kind of factoring into the environmental plan for this year and beyond for this new governor?
Well, I think the next question is going to be the legislative session. Ron DeSantis, Governor DeSantis, has laid out this sweeping environmental plan. He's laid out the spending plan. And so I think a lot of people are now wondering whether the legislature will fund it. Mm-hmm. And I talked with one source this week who talked to me about how she is hopeful. She talked to me about how when Governor DeSantis announced his executive order, part of the announcement was the Senate president and the House speaker. And so that was encouraging to her. But you can plan on the environmental groups making this a big focus in the legislative session.
Mm-hmm. So they won't be happy with just seeing a few things kind of done at the start of the session. They want to see that continue. Well, Amy Green is 90.7's environmental reporter. Thank you so much for joining us.
You are welcome.
We're also joined by Russell Bryant. He's a former board member of the friends of the Wakaiva Springs and the Wakaiva Springs swims rather in the Wakaiva Springs every day. Thank you so much, Russell.
My pleasure.
And we're also joined by Clay Henderson. He is with the Stetson Water Institute. Thank you so much as well, Clay.
Good to be here.
Coming up next, we hear about the impact of the shutdown on contract workers on the Space Coast. That's when Intersection returns in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The partial government shutdown ended a week ago, but the impact is still being felt by federal workers and contractors who are waiting on back pay. Among the contractors affected in Central Florida are aerospace workers in the space industry. To find out what's next for those contractors, we talk to Kevin D'Amico. He's the business representative with the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. He says they're hoping legislation filed by U.S. Representatives Chris Smith, a Republican from New Jersey, and fellow New Jersey Representative Donald Norcross, a Democrat, can help those contractors get paid. Kevin, obviously the focus this week is on trying to get some of that back pay for contract workers. Give me your perspective of what's going on from the union's point of view.
Well, we've had some representatives up in the Capitol introduce a bill, H.R. 824, that is called the Fairness to Federal Contractors Act of 2019. And we can't get nobody to co-sponsor that bill. We have Representative Norcross and Representative Smith have put this bill together with other people, and we can't get no one to co-sponsor it.
What is the bill asking for?
The bill is asking for back pay for our workers here. You know, the International Association of Machinists, we have tens of thousands of people throughout the country that that work for federal contractors. They work side by side with whether it be NASA, the FAA, the Coast Guard, and we're asking the bill to back pay these people like the federal. Like the federal government was, to a maximum of $1,400 per week. We don't think that's unreasonable. It's not hitting nowhere near the top pay of these employees, but these employees, they have families, and it's real life. You know, you start missing a month's pay or so, it can be devastating to everyday families that are trying to live. You know, pay their mortgage, feed their kids, clothe them. All that. And when you start losing 8% of your pay a year, it can be devastating.
This obviously isn't the first partial government shutdown we've experienced, but it is the longest. But I'm wondering, from the point of view of the union trying to negotiate for back pay, give me a sense of where this fits in. Like, have you experienced this before? Have you had to try and fight for back pay after a shutdown in the past?
Yeah, we've had members here recently. You know, over the last year, you know, we've had three shutdowns in our government, and we still have guys that haven't gotten paid from the last shutdown. But yeah, we're experiencing people not getting paid for these government shutdowns, and it's just a shame. You know, usually they're not that long. Here today, here we sit, you know, a 35-day shutdown, and no one's wanting to stand up for the middle class other than our representatives, Norcross and Smith, and other people.
There is a kind of a deadline on this too, right? I mean, there's 2 weeks before the government could potentially shut down again. Do you have a strategy for that, or what are your thoughts kind of leading up to that mid-February deadline when there could be another shutdown if there's been no resolution on border security and the other things that President Trump is pushing for?
Yeah, we're looking at, you know, another 15 days. This could all be happening again. And I would hate to see that happen. I hope our legislators can come to an agreement on something that'll work for everybody. It's just ridiculous to put the working people as pawns in this project that they're trying to do, or this legislation. They should come to agreement on something. And, you know, just hope that You know, I hope people reach out to their legislators and call them to support the working people of this country. I know it hasn't affected a lot of people, but it's affected hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. If we don't stick together in this country and stop the divide, things to come ain't going to be much better. So if this is to where we're at, where we're stopping, where our federal government is stopping people from gaining a paycheck because of politics, we've gone too far. You know, I'm not here advocating for Democrats or Republicans. I'm here advocating for working families of America, and that they deserve to have their voices heard also.
Kevin D'Amico is with the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. He's the business representative for the union. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Well, listening to that conversation is 90.7 Space reporter Brendan Byrne. What did you hear there?
Well, I heard frustration, and that seems to be what we've heard from contract workers at Kennedy Space Center and throughout the agency of NASA throughout this shutdown is frustration. These are people that want to work, and they weren't able to work for more than a month. And now it seems like, you know, a good bulk of these folks are not going to get paid for that time off.
You reported earlier this week, Brendan, on a town hall led by NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine. How does what you're hearing from Kevin D'Amico with the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers kind of fit in with what we heard from Bridenstine earlier?
Right. So Bridenstine was holding his State of NASA, which really should be something that is kind of forward-looking and the things that are going to come from the agency throughout the year. But it was really dominated by this government shutdown. And it was held at NASA headquarters, but Bridenstine asked for questions throughout the agency, across the country. You could submit questions and then upvote the questions that you thought were the best questions to be asked. And at the top of that list, right before the town hall, with 500 votes, was what is NASA going to do to protect our contractors that are here? We have estimates from Congressman Bill Posey's office that of the 13,000 people that work at NASA's Kennedy Space Center, just one center, 11,000 are contract workers. So it's a huge, huge portion of the NASA workforce is these contract workers. And Bridenstine didn't have an answer for what we could do to kind of help the folks that were affected now. But the administrator wants to, going forward, standardize these contracts so that a resolution could come a little bit easier than it is now. Right now, there's all sorts of different contracts that are paid out at different times, whether or not they're paid in full at the beginning or they're paid once work is done. And it's really difficult to negotiate back pay when you have all of these different contracts there. So Bridenstine wants to standardize those contracts moving forward. Now, whether or not that will happen, we'll see, but at least it's on the forefront of his mind.
And I guess the fact that this shutdown was so long sort of really shone a spotlight on the technicalities and the complexities of trying to get back pay for the contracted workers there.
It really didn't. I think it also shined a spotlight on the work that contractors do at, throughout the agency and other federal agencies. For instance, all of the people that do the broadcasting of the Ultima Thule flyby, which is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for a spacecraft to fly by something so far in our solar system, that was done by contractors.
And just as a reminder, that's that funny-shaped bit of rock, which
yes,
is about the size of Orlando, which is whizzing around billions of miles away from Earth.
Exactly. And there was a scramble to figure out, well, how is NASA going to communicate such an incredible mission and this really cool thing that's happening when NASA TV was shut down? And it turned out, Jim Bridenstine said that, you know, over the holiday break, he tried to figure out how to do that, and it turned out that some of those broadcasters were paid in advance on their contract, which is how they were able to do it. Had they not been, we might not have been able to see that. And there were other agencies that were going to step in that were going to do that. Another issue is brain drain. And that was brought up at this NASA town hall as well, is that, you know, how can you keep, you know, the people that are in the top of their field when there's so much economic uncertainty here? Mm-hmm. And Bridenstine definitely acknowledged that and said, yeah, we're going to lose some people because of this. Some people are going to leave the federal workforce and go to something a little more stable like the private workforce because of this. So they have to work to figure out how are we going to keep these people in. And that's kind of the reason why the heads of these agencies don't want these shutdowns, is because it really is disruptive.
90.7's Brendan Byrne is our space reporter following the aftermath from the shutdown and looking to what's ahead. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Still to come on Intersection, A Tale of Two Cities, the musical.
You are not afraid.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. This weekend, Central Florida Vocal Arts presents a musical interpretation of the classic novel by Charles Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities. Here's baritone David Bracamonte and soprano Sarah Izzola performing an excerpt from the musical.
Sent to me.
When I hold your hand, all my fears are in the past. But when I let go, do you promise they'll be fast?
Like a lightning flash, all your suffering. Can be no farewells. We will meet where the weary find peace.
And that was baritone David Bracamonte and soprano Sarah Izzola singing an excerpt from the musical A Tale of Two Cities. Well, Bracamonte and Izzola are with us now in the studio, along with the show's producer, Teresa Smith-Levin, to talk about setting the Dickens classic to music. David Bracamonte, Sarah Izzola, and Teresa Smith-Levin, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, thank you.
So tell me a little bit about the musical, Teresa. What can audiences expect?
Absolutely. So we're producing the Central Florida premiere of A Tale of Two Cities. It's a musical by Jill Santoriello based on the Charles Dickens novel. It was produced on Broadway about 10 years ago, so we're really excited to bring it to Orlando. And it has all of the juicy drama and intensity of the Charles Dickens novel, but also balanced with a little levity, with some fun stuff that happens throughout and all the beauty of a musical that you would expect.
Had you seen it performed on the stage before?
We had not. There are some YouTube videos where you can see segments of the show on Broadway as well as concert versions. Mm-hmm. So we're excited to bring this to the stage here.
Sarah, is this one of your first musicals? Is this the first time you've been on stage, or have you done this a few times before?
So, yeah, I've been doing professional theater for probably 2 or 3 years.
And how does this kind of fit in? Like, how much work has gone into this production compared to previous ones?
So there's obviously been a lot of work, and it's turned out really great. Most of the other shows I've done, I've had a lot more, like, time commitments, like 9-to-5 rehearsals. So this one is definitely more, it gives me more leeway to do other things, but it's been awesome.
And tell me about your character in the musical.
Yeah, so my character is the seamstress. She comes in Act 2. And so she, in the first act, Sydney Carton has little Lucy, and she kind of helps him become a better person. And I come in Act 2, and my character is sentenced to death. So I meet Sydney Carton right when I'm in line to be sentenced to death, and he gives me strength, and he helps me kind of just be okay with what's happening, and he helps me not be scared anymore.
What about your character, David, and tell me a little bit about the character of Sydney Carton, which you play.
Sure. Sydney is a very complex man. He begins the show as this broken lawyer who's doesn't really have a place outside of a bar. He kind of is drinking his life away, doesn't have any real friends, any real community, any real family. And he encounters these people who just completely throw him for a loop and make him question everything about himself. And you really get to see the progression of him as a human. And I think it's really a beautiful progression of the human condition, where somebody, you know, we all at our core are good. And I think he really is a testament to that.
So how much of the musical is singing and how much of it is acting?
This particular show, I would say, is a good 50-50 mix. There's some beautiful scene work in this show. But the music, the music for any musical, I think, is really the star. But I will say for this show in particular, I'm enjoying the scene work just as much. It's some really nice scene work.
Mm-hmm. And was it a musical you'd heard about before?
I had not. I'd never heard of this musical before. And I'm so happy that I get to experience it because it's and I'm so happy we get to share it with, you know, the Central Florida community, because this show should be heard. The music is spectacular. It's some great stuff that, you know, even as a voice teacher myself, stuff that I want to take and use and give to my students, because it's really stuff that should be used and should be showcased and can showcase a variety of talent as well.
Mm-hmm. Teresa, tell me a little bit about the song we just heard Sarah and David perform. Whereabouts in the show does that come in?
Absolutely. That's actually our finale number. So after that first segment, the whole chorus comes in and this beautiful sort of closing to the show. So as Sarah said, she's sort of the symbolic embodiment of little Lucy, who has been the person who has really helped change Sydney. And they find each other in this moment right before death. And he provides her this strength and this assurance that even in this world that seems so unjust, that there's beauty as they're going to die. And I just think that's such a relevant theme. So that finale happens right before the end of the show.
Mm-hmm. Is it something you think is going to resonate with younger audience as well?
I do. You know, as a producer, when we're choosing shows and we're deciding what we want our season to look like, I'm really influenced by what stories do we want to tell and why is this show important. The music is stunning, like David said, but for me, it's the themes that show up in the show that are really, really relevant.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of redemption, this idea that we as a society, as a community, have more in common than we have that separates us, that you can always become better and that you can be a hero for somebody else and provide that support. And for me, that's something that I want to share.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of melodramatic stuff, isn't it, Charles Dickens?
It is. It is. And at the same time, I think that they are core values and themes that we see on a day-to-day life. As we're going through our days, there are so many opportunities for us to be a hero for somebody else, whether it's helping someone cross the street or helping someone pay for their groceries or a child who needs help with school, whatever it might be. There are so many opportunities to be someone's hero.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, had you read this book before embarking on this musical? Were you familiar with much of Charles Dickens?
No, I had not read the book before or even really heard of the musical. I'd heard of the book, but I hadn't read it.
So what do you like about this musical? What kind of strikes a chord with you?
I really like it because it's very different from what I normally do. Like in the past, I've done a lot of either like really big like Broadway style musicals or like children's shows. So this is really fun to kind of get to do something more on like the classical side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And is that where your training is in classical music?
Well, yeah, I've been coaching with Teresa since I was in fourth grade. So yeah, I do a lot of, I would say I mainly do musical theater, but I also have been trained in classical.
David, where does it kind of fit into the canon of works that you've sung in before?
I would say this is pretty typical for what I do professionally. The more legit side of musical theater is kind of where I like to live. But I venture into the opera realm and the more contemporary musical theater on occasion as well.
Any standouts in the other side of musical theater?
The Drowsy Chaperone is kind of a staple that I've done several times. A lot of fun stuff there. But, I mean, shows like this, Les Mis, Sweeney Todd, those are kind of where I live.
Mm-hmm. Is this kind of similar to Les Mis? I mean, it's set mm-hmm. in the same time period and
yes,
country,
so,
right?
Yes, it is. So Les Mis, it takes place before this as far as time period goes. It's kind of the precursor to the French Revolution, whereas this takes place like it is starting. It's mm-hmm. happening right now. Mm-hmm. So we kind of get to see that happen, like the spark that lit the flame that made that happen. And then we really see it get really bad really quickly.
Yeah. Aside from stuff you're performing in, what about opportunities to see musical theater in Central Florida? Is there a kind of a good, aside from what you're performing in, are you able to go and see a lot of musical theater here in this area?
Yeah, I think Central Florida has become such a hub for for musical theater. Yeah. And you don't see – we're such a great arts community. We don't do the shows that everybody else does. You know, you can go to any town and, you know, community theater is going to be doing – and even professional theater is going to be doing South Pacific. They're going to be doing, you know, those big shows, those big, you know, Hairspray, Mamma Mia, those shows that are just going to bring the crowds in that are for sure bets, you know, mm-hmm. that are going to make that money. But I feel like Central Florida has a real thriving art scene, so we can do these more artistic pieces and know that people are going to come and want to see them.
Sarah Izola, what's your favorite musical theater that you've seen on the stage?
My favorite musical I've seen is probably Wicked. I saw it on Broadway. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I can't really let you guys go without asking, were you able to snag some tickets to see Hamilton?
No. And I don't think any of us got to see it. And the other problem is we've been rehearsing every night. So even if we had them, I don't think we would have been able to go. It's very sad. But we heard great things. A lot of my friends on social media, I got to jealously look at their pictures from outside those uplit golden pieces of the Dr. Phillips Center, but heard really wonderful things.
Is it on your bucket list?
Absolutely. My husband wants to go see it on Broadway. So next time we have a lot of money that we'd like to get rid of, and lots of free time that we never have, we'll definitely go see Hamilton.
Do you feel like Hamilton has kind of injected some new life into the genre of musicals?
I do. And you know what I like about it, and it's something that is important to our mission too, is capturing new hearts and minds. I think sometimes we can sort of become isolated and we just work within our audience pool and we don't invite new people to the table. And I think Hamilton is so approachable, and they did such a great job doing these crossover albums where they use contemporary pop artists singing these pieces too to reach even more people. And so they're bringing more people to the table and helping them to experience musical theater and maybe try something that's even different from Hamilton. It's sort of that gateway, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So, Sarah Izola, what is one thing that you're looking forward to about the show and one thing you want audiences to kind of look out for?
Well, I think one thing I'm looking forward to the show is getting it open. I'm really excited about that. And also, just the whole cast is so wonderful, and so is the crew. So it's going to be great.
David, what are you kind of looking forward to most about it?
I'm just really looking forward to sharing the story. It's such an important, poignant piece, and I'm really excited for audiences to be able to be taken on that journey with us. You know, there's a lot there in this story. It's a story of redemption. It's a story of sorrow. There's so much there. I mean, the quote from the show, "It's the best of times and it's the worst of times," really kind of sums it all up. Mm-hmm. About how it really depends on how you're looking at, you know, glass half full, glass half empty kind of thing.
I just want to echo to what David said. It's such an important story to tell. And the other thing that we haven't mentioned yet is we have these youth artists joining us on stage. And throughout the whole run, we're offering half-priced youth tickets to attend the show. Because so many of these kids study this work in school, we want to help them more deeply connect to this text and this story. And I think rather than read the spark notes like I probably did in high school, seeing it on stage would really help them do that. Mm-hmm. So we're inviting youth and adults and everyone to join us. We will be at the Central Florida Community Arts Theater, which is at Central Christian Church. That's 250 Southwest Ivanhoe Boulevard. And we open this Friday at 7:30 p.m. We have shows Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday for those of us who can't join us over the weekend. And then the following weekend, that's the 8th and 9th on Friday and Saturday. All the shows start at 7:30 except that Sunday at 3. And you can find tickets at www.cflvocalarts.com.
Well, Teresa Smith-Levin is producing A Tale of Two Cities. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us, Matt.
Sarah Izola is a soprano in the show. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
And David Bracamonte is a baritone. Thank you as well, David.
Thank you so much.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Production assistance for today's show from Juan Gualda and Amy Green. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.